Tokyo Podcast episode number 37.
Hey everybody, today's show is all about sports. We're going to talk about the traditional Canadian sport of hockey, and we're going to talk about the traditional Japanese sport of kendo. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And I am very excited about today's show because we're going to be talking about sports. We're going to talk about a traditional Canadian sport, which is hockey. And we're going to talk about a traditional Japanese sport, which is kendo. And a few weeks ago, I went and joined the Tokyo Street Hockey Association and dropped in on one of their Friday night games. And for those of you who don't know, street hockey, also known as ball hockey, is played pretty much the same way as ice hockey is played. And the only difference is that we don't play on an ice surface. We play on a regular concrete surface inside a gymnasium, and we use a round ball instead of a rubber hockey puck. But basically, the style and format of the game is the same as ice hockey. And anyways, ice hockey is a tradition that goes way back in Canada, and it's something that a lot of young boys growing up in Canada play in the winter time. In the winter time in Canada, almost everything is frozen, including many of the lakes that a lot of people live near. So what do you do in the winter time? Well, there's not really much to do, but get your hockey stick, your hockey skates, and go out and play some hockey on the many frozen lakes and ponds that are around Canada in the winter time. So it's something that a lot of Canadians grew up playing. And so for the chance for me to start playing some hockey again was very exciting. I haven't played hockey since I was in elementary school. So I was a little bit worried about would I be able to, you know, pick it up again. But after a few minutes of running back and forth and catching my breath a number of times, I found that I was getting back into the groove. And so I had so much fun, actually, that I invited Chad, who runs the Tokyo Street Hockey Association, down to the studio here for a quick interview. Hey, Chad, welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me on.
Now, I want to say that I came out last Friday and played a game of hockey with you guys, and that was the first time I've played hockey in probably about 25, 30 years, and I got to say that it was a lot of fun, and the next day I could not move.
That doesn't surprise me. I've been playing for a long time, and I still sometimes struggle to move the following day.
So tell us about the history of hockey in Tokyo. I'm kind of surprised to see how much hockey there actually is. There's you guys, there's some Japanese leagues, I understand. How did you guys get started?
Yeah, I think, first of all, just to clarify, so we're doing ball hockey or street hockey, which is different. A lot of people hear the word hockey, confuse it with field hockey, which most of the world seems to call it, and many Canadians think it's ice hockey. So the TSHA, we do ball hockey / street hockey. And, you know, we've been around now for, since 1996. So if my math is right, that's 16, maybe 17 years now that we've been around.
Wow.
And I've been in the group for just over 9 years. And it originally got started by a Canadian, no surprise. His name's Paul, and he's still in the group. Doesn't come out as much as we'd like him to, but he basically just wanted to play hockey, and so he put an ad in Metropolis magazine. Back in 1996, Metropolis had a much more extensive classified section, so, you know, everybody was advertising in there for everything. And he just put an ad in, said, if you're interested, let me know, and then once we get enough people, we'll set it up somewhere. And basically, after a few months, they got enough people collected. This was before the internet was really anything big, and there was no email. So they had to call everybody and leave voicemails to set this up. But eventually, they got it going. That was going on in Komazawa Park. And, they were just using pylons as nets. Yeah, they just went from there. A few months in, I'm not 100% sure about this. Another guy I think you might have met named Dave, he joined, and him and Paul basically ran it for the last 16 years. And in 2007, actually, while we were still playing in Osaka, another fella came from Canada. His name was John, and he was very serious about ball hockey. And he got us going on this tournament, and we went out to a couple tournaments. We went to Nagoya, we went to Korea, and we started hosting our own tournament. We also started the league, which I'm currently running now.
And your schedule right now is you guys play every Friday, is that correct?
Not every Friday. We try to keep one Friday open so people can, you know, I guess go get drunk and not have to play hockey prior.
But it's typically on Fridays that you guys play?
Yeah. Right now we're only doing the first, second, and third Friday of every month. And the venue, I guess, is changing really soon. We're going to be playing out in Edogawaku. The station is Mizue. We're at Edogawa Sports Garden out there. That's an outdoor rink, really nice. And the reason we're moving to the outdoors is just because the indoor place gets too hot in the summer in Tokyo, as you probably felt last time you were out. It's getting pretty steamy in there. So basically that rink shuts down middle of July until early September. So we've got the rink out in Edogawa that we're going to try and play at. And we found a new one in Yokohama, so we're going to hopefully be able to test that out as well.
Okay, cool. And who are the members? Is it all Canadians, or where do the members come from?
Let's see. I wouldn't say it's all Canadians, but it's predominantly Canadians. Maybe
I'd say we Canadians love our hockey.
We do love our hockey. We love it in all shapes and forms. I would say maybe 75-80% is Canadian people. That would be my guess. Probably 15% or so Americans, and I know I'm gonna when the guys at hockey hear this, the American guys are gonna give me some grief about that because it's probably more. And then 5% miscellaneous. We get, you know, I think in our time we've had probably maybe 15 or 20 nationalities out there. We've had
so it's not just for Canadians, right? It's
no
everyone's welcome.
Anybody who wants to play, they don't even have to be, you know, too familiar with the sport. It's something they can pick up pretty quickly. You know, the physical part of it, just the running part, is tough on people who've never played or ran that sort of style before. But, you know, just learning to hold the stick and picking up a ball with the stick is something you actually can catch on to pretty quickly after a few times. Most of those guys are running a little bit more smoothly, trying to take shots. I think it's the first two times people come out, it's generally the most intimidating because we're running fast and they're not so used to that style. Of course, we always have first timers out there who show us a thing or two as well.
And you have Japanese people that come out as well?
Yeah, we have. Not so much recently, unfortunately. When we played in Osaka, we had a few guys who were quite regular, some university guys who played ice hockey or inline hockey. And when we do the Yamato Cup tournament every year, we've had a Japanese team from the inline league come out, and they always do exceptionally well. They're great hockey players.
Right. Yeah. And what's the skill level like? If someone, you know, is maybe listening to this and they haven't played in a while, maybe perhaps they're a little bit worried about coming out, what would you say the kind of skill levels like of the players?
I wouldn't say that's really an issue at all. I mean, you know, you yourself came out last time and you said you hadn't played for about 20, 25 years. And, you know, after the initial 30, 40 minutes of getting used to it, I think you acclimatized quite well. You started running with the group a bit more and getting the shots off. And you see that with everybody who comes out. So if they've got any experience with hockey, whether it's line hockey, ice hockey, ball hockey somewhere else, even field hockey, it's pretty easy to get into the swing of things once you get used to the rhythm of how we play. Skill level, it's so varied. I mean, we have guys out there who have never played, or, you know, they've only played two or three times with us, and we have guys out there who've been playing hockey, you know, their whole lives. And we, you know, we're learning from each other as we play too, trying to help each other get better. Because that's, I mean, it's a fun little community, and we're always trying to make it a little bit better so that every single time we go out there and play, it's better than the last time.
And you guys also have female players, right? It's not just all a bunch of guys. I noticed last time there was a couple of ladies that were playing as well.
That's true, yeah. We have probably about four or five right now that come out semi-regularly. Again, that's one demographic I'd like to see more of. We're trying to get more diversity in the group in terms of males and females and even age. I think when you were out, you saw a couple of younger guys out there as well. So we had the youngest guy was 13, and we had a 17-year-old. We've had a couple 16-year-old guys come out with their with their dads. So yeah, I mean, males and females, young and old. You know, we've tried to get as diverse as we can, but still room to grow in that area.
Is there a cost to members to play? I imagine there's some type of cost to cover the rental of the rink.
Yeah, definitely. We do have to pay for the rinks, unfortunately. So for first-timers, it's 500 yen for the first night, 1,000 yen for the second night. And then from there, it depends on which rink we're playing at. So if we're at the more expensive rink, which is the indoor one, it goes to 1,500 and then finally 2,000. So 2,000 is the normal price per night for anybody, but it kind of builds up to that if you're a first-timer. Females and kids are always 500 yen, and goalies pay 500 yen everywhere. At the outdoor rink, it is just $1,000 a head, and then for first-timers, 500. Yeah, 1,000. First-timers are also 500, females 500, and goalies 500. So,
do you have a lot of goalies?
The number of goalies is really volatile. We went for maybe 13 years without a goalie.
Wow, really? What'd you use, a shooter tutor the whole time?
What's that?
How did you play without a goalie? Do you use?
Well, I didn't incorporate this part into the history of the group, but when they started, it was just a pylon that they had to hit, and then it moved up to 100 yen laundry baskets. Right. And net technology evolved, so they had these kind of pop-out nets. We bought a couple of those, but they were really light, so they often blew away, which was a pain in the ass. And then I bought some metal nets. When I used to live in Asakusa next to the rink, so it was about, I don't know, 500 meters. So my neighbor and I would cart these two big metal nets down to the rink and play with those, which were great. And those had shooter tutors. And then, yeah, we had one guy come out. He wasn't really a goalie to start with, but he bought himself some pads and made a blocker out of cardboard and stuff so he could play in net. And then after that, we had a few more goalies come out. So right now, the goalie count's probably three or four. But, you know, it's usually we get two out per night, maybe three. So
right. You know what I love about the history of your group is that it's exactly how us kids played hockey when, you know, back in Canada. Because, you know, you don't have a goalie. Half the kids don't have equipment. You just have a tennis ball, some sticks, and then you put, like, you know, the green garbage can, you know, upside down or something like that, you know? Or you take, like, yeah, you know, okay, between this street curb and that street light is the goal or something. Or, you know, you have to hit this shoe or this tennis shoe or something. And same thing. I mean, then one kid gets for Christmas, gets a net, and we're like just, oh my God. So we're all carting it out to the tennis court. And I remember making a blocker out of piece of wood and foam and just, you know, putting Velcro around it.
I had some flashbacks for sure. Yeah. Baseball gloves as catchers. And I never taped any phone books to my shins. I've just been using the soccer shin pads. But yeah, especially in the early days, it was really, really old school. It was great. Right. It has definitely been an evolutionary process, though. I would love to make one of those evolution of man kind of posters for the nets and for the other equipment that we've been using, because it would be perfect going from a pylon to all the way up to a goaltender. So
yeah, because I was actually surprised to see the equipment that your goalie was wearing. I mean, it looked like full-on NHL gear, which they both had on. So I was a little bit surprised at that.
Yeah, the guys that come out, they're ice hockey goalies. They've got all the gear, so they want to use it. As you probably noticed, though, it gets a little hot when you're not playing on an ice rink if you're
right.
entirely ice hockey gear as a goaltender. But
right. And the other thing that I wanted to just make sure we get on the air, because you mentioned this on your website, is that you guys don't actually have equipment to lend out, right? It's not like someone can just show up and then there's sticks available, gloves available. People have to take responsibility to get their own equipment.
Yeah, ideally. I mean, you know, you and I think, discussed this off air. It is, sticks are quite expensive now that they've moved into these composites. Back in the day when it was predominantly wooden sticks, you could get those for, you know, 2,000-3,000 yen. But now, yeah, you know, nobody really wants to put in, you know, 10,000 yen for a stick and then show up one time. So if people are interested in coming out and they want to borrow a stick, they just have to get in touch with the info@tokyohockey.com address. Let me know the way they shoot and approximately how tall they are, and I'll try and muster up a stick for them. When it comes to stuff like gloves and, you know, shin guards, and if they want to wear a helmet or other protective gear, yeah, that's totally up to them. I can't find all that stuff, but definitely sticks, just given the fact that nowadays they're becoming a little expensive for a one-time, two-time investment. So.
Right. Tell me about the Yamato Cup. What is it? Is it a tournament that you guys are in?
Yeah, Yamato Cup's a ball hockey tournament that we organize, we run. So like I said, this year it's going to be our fifth year. And we run it every year in October on the long weekend. So this year it's going to be October 6th. And like I said, maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, this fellow from Canada named John, who was quite serious about ball hockey, he came over here. And that was one of his objectives, is to get this tournament started over here. He really had a vision for ball hockey in Asia. And so we got that going, and we got the team from Korea. Korea's got a pretty large group, actually. They sent a team over, and we got the Japanese group from the inline league here to play, as well as three Tokyo-based teams from our group and another. And that was the first time it happened, so we've done it every year, long weekend in October. It's a great time. It's a full day of ball hockey. This year, Korea's coming back. They are a very good team. They've won two of them. And we're going to have a team from Hong Kong coming. 2 years ago, we had a team from Slovakia come over and play. And yeah, it's been a great time and a really good opportunity to meet, you know, some passionate ball hockey fans from other parts of the world.
Wow, that sounds exciting. I'm looking forward to checking that out this October.
Yeah, I hope you're going to play too.
And if people want to find out more information about street hockey in Tokyo, they can check out your website at tokyohockey.com. And how do they find out about when the next game is?
The easiest thing to do is go to tokyohockey.com, and there's a button there that says, I believe it says join. And you go to the join button, click on the join button, and you'll just have to sign up, and you'll get the website. You'll get the newsletter. And the newsletter is usually every week, and it'll tell you when the next game's coming up.
Fantastic. Well, I hope anyone who's interested in playing some hockey, whatever your skill level's at, whether you're just starting off or you're the next Wayne Gretzky, male or female, come on and join, because I got to say, like, I really enjoyed it. I thought the level of play was great. It was competitive, but not too aggressive. Fast-paced game. And I was lucky that I managed to redeem myself by scoring a couple of goals. So
you did, yeah. That was great.
Thanks to a beauty pass from you, which the first time I fanned on. So
don't expect too many more of those in the future. But
if people want to check out more about Tokyo Hockey, visit tokyohockey.com. Thanks, Chad.
Thank you very much, Anthony.
Kendo, which means way of the sword, is the modern Japanese martial art of sword fighting that is based on traditional swordsmanship that was practiced by the samurai during the feudal era Japan. My guest today is Lance Lindley, who practiced Kendo with the Japan Maritime Self-Defense Force and achieved the rank of Shodan. He joins me today to talk about his experiences in studying this traditional martial art here in Japan. Hey, Lance, welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Can you give us a quick background on your time and how you came to Japan? I understand that you're with the U.S. Navy.
Yep, that's correct.
And was it the Navy that brought you here originally?
It was. I first came over in 1994, stationed aboard the USS Independence. I stayed and went to an Admiral Staff, and then I stayed again and went to USS Kitty Hawk. And then I left, went to Italy, went to the States, and then I came back to the same Admiral Staff again, and then I transferred again now up to an Admiral Staff in Atsugi.
So. Oh, okay. And how did you get into kendo? I take it this isn't offered in the U.S. Navy, is it?
No, it's not. You know, a lot of the Japanese groups, like the JMSDF does it, the Japanese police are very strong at it because it's a very traditional sport for them. But the U.S. Navy doesn't have anything like that that they offer. Now, they do sometimes offer classes here in Japan on the base, but it's not exactly Navy-sponsored. It's something that our morale and welfare, you know, organization just offers, brings Japanese teachers on to teach kendo or karate and things like that.
So how did you get into the sport, and what attracted you to kendo?
Well, in the 90s when I first got here, I was really interested in samurai culture, and I was studying Japanese history on my own. I was reading a lot of really dry textbooks, and I was reading a lot of Zen texts and things like that, and I knew all the names, and I was kind of interested in taking a sword martial art. I had taken really basic American sport karate back in the States when I was younger, but I wanted to do something that was more linked with the samurai. And so I had kind of been eyeing a couple of different things. One is called Iaido, which is a martial art of it's almost like the Wild West quick draw with the six guns. In Iaido, it's all about how quickly can you draw and cut with your sword in one movement. The idea being that in the old days in a sword duel, a lot of times the reality was they were decided immediately in one blow. There wasn't a whole lot of this fencing like you'd see in the martial arts movies. It's kind of whoever could get their sword out the fastest and cut with it would be the winner. So that's what Iaido is based on. And I had an interest in that, and I did end up actually taking that in addition to kendo. And then I saw kendo. At first, I wanted to go with kenjutsu, which is a little different. Kenjutsu is more the traditional, real martial art of sword fighting, whereas kendo is sort of the sport version of it. In kenjutsu, there's no points and things like that, and there's really no tournaments. You're just studying kata, kata, kata again and again and again. And at the end, not only was it going to be troublesome to find somebody to teach me that, I thought, well, might as well get into a situation where I can actually, you know, whack people with a bamboo sword and have a little bit of, you know, kind of interaction that way instead of just doing dry kata again and again with the sensei, because I've done that, and that's what you do in Iaido. And a lot of that is, you know, you draw your sword and you hold it in just such a way, and the sensei steps over and he adjusts your wrist by a quarter of an inch, you know, and gives you this frown, you know, right, because you've done it wrong again.
You damn foreigner, how did you not know that?
you and your quarter inch wrist problems. And I, believe me, I have tons of quarter inch and full inch wrist problems and things because I don't get a lot of, I'm not good at martial arts very much, and certainly things that are that precise. I don't get a lot of feedback from my joints and things the way that a true athlete would, you know. So you could adjust me all day long and tell me I'm a quarter inch off, and I'm just never going to feel it when it happens. So okay. So I said, well, hey, you know, kendo, I'll feel that. When somebody hits me on the head with a stick, I'm going to know that I messed up and missed. So I went for kendo. It was offered to me actually by a woman, a Japanese woman that I worked with on the Admiral staff at that time. She had mentioned that she knew some people in the Japan Maritime Self-Defense Force that had a kendo dojo going. And that she thought that they'd be excited to have a foreigner come on and join them. So she kind of was my liaison between the two, and I got hooked up with them, and that's how it happened.
Interesting. So what was it like the first few times that you went? Did you speak Japanese? Were you the only foreigner there?
I was the only foreigner there, and to this day, I was probably one of only two. I mean, I'm only guessing here, but the second one was one that I introduced to them later. I'll tell you, I think it would have been, I didn't speak a lot of Japanese at that time. I had only been in the country a couple of years at that point, and I'd spent most of that on an aircraft carrier that really was at sea more than it was in port. So I hadn't had a chance to study much at that time. But I'll tell you what, the guys that were in the dojo were so fantastic. They were so friendly. They were so fun. They actually became my friends, even outside the dojo. And, you know, I left Japan and I came back, and I'm kind of sorry that I haven't been able to find them since then, because I just have great memories of what a great bunch of guys they were. And they were so welcoming and so much fun, and especially the two senior guys, the two real senseis, which I think one was a Rokudan, a sixth Dan, and one may have been a Nanadan. But they may have both been six, but they were just really fantastic guys, a lot of fun. They were really proud to be showing kendo to a foreigner, and I think that made it a lot more easy for me to be in there. I think if there would have been an attitude of unwelcome or something, that I might not have stuck with it.
Wow, so can you tell me a little bit about what the training is like? How do they start you off? Do they give you that stick and you start whacking people on the head, or what's the beginner level training like?
Sure. The first thing you have to learn is the foot movement, the footwork, and it's deceptively difficult. Hmm. One of the things that I remember about kendo was that, you know, if you watch these guys do it, well, first of all, you have a hard time seeing their feet because they wear the hakama that almost drags the floor. And that's on purpose. That's so the opponent can't really see the footwork. And there's not a whole lot to it. I mean, you're not talking about dance steps here, but as with so many martial arts moves, to do it right is deceptively difficult. And so they'll start you off just doing this forward and backward motion with the foot again and again and again and again and again. And then, you know, you'll go forward, you go back, you go forward, you go back. And then they may walk over after you've done that for about 10 minutes and say, okay, now I want you to just go forward from, you know, this end of the dojo to that end of the dojo. When you reach the other end, turn around and come back. And they're trying to ingrain, you know, build this muscle memory of how the footwork goes, because if the footwork's wrong, everything's going to be wrong. And what it really, it's probably going to be hard to explain without visuals, but basically, when you're standing still and you're standing ready and it looks like nothing's happening, you're really in this stance that I believe the Japanese call tame, I think. And it's like in baseball when you're waiting for the pitch to come and your muscles are all coiled and you're ready to release that swing. So you're kind of like right on the moment of tension, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And that's kind of what you're at when you're standing in your balanced, ready stance in kendo, is you're waiting to spring. And you're watching the other guy and you're waiting for him to maybe make the first move, or you're waiting for some kind of sign that he's not ready for you to make the move. And when that instant happens, you have to be ready to explode off of your back foot, which is your left foot. And explode forward, but you don't just leap. You don't want to get any kind of height on your movement. Trying to explode forward so your right foot, which is your front foot, is going to slide not quite along the floor, because sometimes you do this on tatami, but it's going to slide just the barest fraction of an inch above the floor. And then in spite of the fact that it's so close to the floor, when you plant and do your actual sword strike, bam, that foot is going to slam the floor as a part of your power. So it's kind of difficult because you're in this tension mode. You explode forward, but you're trying to explode in a very linear fashion along the floor, not raising your head. You know, you're trying to stay really linear. And then, bam, stomp your foot at the same time that you're landing your strike and shouting your kiai, which is your war scream, more or less. And so you got to get that footwork down for anything else to work.
So that's why in the tournaments, if you watch a kendo tournament, it doesn't seem to be as much back and forth as if when you're watching fencing. You see them kind of posed there a lot more, it seems.
You may get a little bit of kind of schwacking each other's, they're called shinai, the bamboo sticks are.
Right.
You may kind of tap the other guy's shinai. You're looking for a weakness. You'll see a lot more of that at the lower ranks, to tell you the truth. You'll see a lot more screaming and a lot more hopping. And actually, if you go to like a younger kind of kendo tournament, like one that's going to have high school and junior high kids in it, you'll see a lot of bouncing around. And these guys, when they're waiting for their strike, they're hopping from foot to foot. You know, they're going, yeah, 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 and they're hopping and all that stuff. And my senseis used to tell me, don't mimic that. That's little kid kendo. And he used to call it, I think he used to call it bantam rooster kendo or something like that. They're like two chickens squaring off to fight,
right,
in the hen house. And he said, that's wrong. Because, and if you think about it, if you're hopping from foot to foot and the guy, your opponent, is good, he's just going to time it to that moment when you're in the air. You've lost contact with the floor. You have no ability now to move or counter. Your feet are not in contact with the floor. Or even after, if he's a little bit late and you've landed on your front foot now, you're off balance and you can't make a strike. So especially if you're hopping rhythmically, you're really showing your opponent what your rhythm is, what your tempo is. You're showing him your timing, and he's just going to judge the waves and strike at a moment that's opportune to him. So you watch two guys that are like sixth rank, actually even less than that, fifth, sixth, seventh rank. These guys, they almost like they're standing perfectly still. They don't whack each other's shinai around and all that stuff. They're watching each other's eyes, and they're waiting for weakness. They're trying to read, when's he going to move? Because the best time to strike is that split second that you're about to strike me for a multitude of reasons. Because your balance is changing, your mindset is changing, you're less defensive and now more offensive. And so that's what they're looking for. Who's going to make the first move? Can I find a weakness in that other guy? And they may be trying to bluff each other. Hey, here's my weakness. Aren't you going to attack it? You know, I don't know. But so they don't hop around and scream as much. They just stand and stare, and they're waiting for that moment.
In the tournaments, how are points scored? Is it because sometimes I've seen tournaments where it seems like one guy hit the other guy and nothing happened. No one raised the flag or anything like that. So is it a specific spot on the body that has to be hit, or how does that work?
Actually, that's an excellent question. And the truth of the matter is, it's two things. There are certain spots that will score you points, but and I imagine this may be the same in boxing. I'm not a big boxing fan, but it has to be done right. And that's really the confusing part to an outsider, or even to me as a foreigner participating in the sport without a lot of experience, is it's a judgment call as to whether you struck with the proper form, the proper power, and the proper spirit to score a point. So the easiest thing to talk about first is what are the point areas. You have basically four. You have kote, which is the wrist. And it's really only one wrist, and it would be the, I think it's your left wrist, okay? So you pop that guy on the left wrist with your shinai, and that could be a point, and that's called kote. And you're supposed to scream the point you're going for as you strike it. You're supposed to. If you really listen, most people are just going, "Gah!" you know, or whatever, but you're supposed to be going, "Kote!" you know, when you hit the kote.
Right.
Because you know, it's not a game of eight ball. It's not a slop game. You're supposed to be calling your shots, basically. The next one is do, which is a slicing move across the chest, and you will usually do this moving forward past your opponent. You may, if you've watched video of it, you may notice sometimes the two guys will charge each other and go past each other, and keep on going, and then turn around in an almost ritual way, or other times they may turn around like it's a fight and they're really fast about it. And that's a lot of times they're going for a kote, or a do strike there, which is across the chest. It's like you're cutting through the rib cage. It's a lateral slice, a horizontal slice. And that can only, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong about this, that can really only be done with your sword to your left as you cut. I don't think you can pass to the right and do it. The most common point is men, which is the head strike. And it's a certain spot, really, about an inch or two maybe right behind the mask. Up on the top of the head, and all of these things, except for the do, the chest strike, all of these things require you to strike with this certain spot on your shinai that would be the sweet spot of your blade if it was a real samurai sword. It's a couple of inches from the very tip. And you need, again, to strike with a proper focus, proper power, proper spirit. And that's part of where the foot stomp comes in, but I'll get to that in a second. Then the final point is what's called tsuki, which is basically spearing your opponent in the Adam's apple. The mask has an Adam's apple protector that drops down in the front, and there's a piece of there's the cloth that the whole gear is made out of, and then in front of that there's this little super hard, it's a hardened leather that sticks down, and if you nail that basically represents shoving your sword through your opponent's throat, skewering him. Wow. And I'll tell you, kote hurts most of the time because you're getting shot right on those, right on the radius and all the bones there.
Where would that land on you? It lands on your wrist?
Yeah, it lands right on the wrist bones for the most part, right there on those two bones, which I'm they're pretty knobby. And you get a guy that hits you with pretty good power, and it freaking hurts. I mean, Kote hurts. But I'll tell you what, nothing sucks like being the victim of the Tsuki throat thing. Because the way it usually goes down also is you're charging, and all of a sudden your feet are still going and your neck's not. And you've got this shinai with all of your force now kind of centered in the very tip of the shinai right on the center of your throat. Throat protector or not, you're like, and you're screaming because you're charging. You're like, yeah, ah! You know, it's just, if you can imagine just chopping yourself in the Adam's apple or hitting yourself in the Adam's apple with a ball ping hammer while you're screaming.
Right.
That's kind of what it's like. And a lot of times your feet will go right out from under you, and you know, it's good for a laugh for all the observers, but that one always sucked, and that's one I always try to make a point to defend against when I'm charging in. It's like, you're not getting me there.
What are some of the methods of defending? If someone's going for your hand or for a man's strike, do you try to defend by moving your hand, or do you try to defend with your shinai?
A little of both, and sometimes you'll offer it, and a lot of times Kote will be the bait that you'll offer. You try to offer that. If you make it too obvious, you know, a savvy opponent's going to go, okay, you're offering it. I'm not going to take it. I see what you're trying to do. So, you know, you hang it out there, and when he takes the bait, you move it. Again, one of the things you're just trying to do is you're just trying to lure him into action. You're trying to make him move, because as long as both of you are not moving and you're in that stasis where you're just staring at each other, really nobody's got an advantage. But as soon as somebody starts to move, now you could calculate who's got some advantages here. So you're trying to lure him out with that kote, or you're trying to subtly lower your guard a little so that without him realizing you're doing it, suddenly your men looks tempting. Hey, that seems wide open to me, you know. Now, when he goes to hit it, you can just kind of move your head a little, because again, you got to hit a precise point. And you got to hit it properly. A glancing blow is not, it's got to be a killing blow, is basically what the judges are basing it on. It's got to be considered a killing blow. And that's why also the points, I'm kind of wandering all over the place here, but the different things kind of have values too. If I get you a kote attack and that's all that happens in that strike and I do it properly, then I get a point and we'll reset and we'll start again. But if I get a kote at the same time as you get a men, and it's considered what they call Ayuchi, which is the same, boom, same moment, you're going to get the point instead of me, because a kote will chop your hand off and probably end the fight, but a head strike is a kill shot, so the kill shot's worth more. Similarly, a doe attack is not considered really a kill shot, so the men is superior to that. I never really figured out where the Tsuki fits in that, but I would be surprised if you could hit somebody properly while you're getting hit in the throat with the shinai anyway. But so those matter. So all you really got to do, if somebody's trying to do a strike with the men, if you just nod your head a little to the right and he basically lands the blow on your left ear, he didn't get the shot right. So that's one way of defending against it. Just slightly pull your wrist closer to your body and he's going to miss that kote attack. A really subtle flick outwards with your wrist will deflect it with your shinai. And as is the case with probably every martial art, when you're trying to get good at this, what you're trying to do is not block with really large, drastic movements that leave you off balance and wide open. You're trying to block with the smallest possible move that will make the guy miss. So there's a whole lot of judgment stuff that goes in there with the judges, again, of did you stomp at the exact moment that your shinai hit? Did you hit the exact right spot on the equipment? Were you screaming right as that happened? And not just screaming, ah, and then you happened to hit in the middle of that. When your sword made its contact, you went, ah, you know. It was all synced up, and it was the proper feeling and the proper focus. And so you'll see these guys come in, and you're like, I don't know what was wrong with that. And as the kendoist, you may feel like, I just got cheated. I know I stomped my foot just right. That felt really good. That felt like a home run swing. That was the cream cheese of, you know, the perfect hitting with the perfect spot of the, and you come out of it with nothing, and you're like, geez, I don't know what I did wrong there, and I don't know if I'm going to do anything better than that. But that's what they're looking for, is this kind of precision that they're tuned to watch for.
So if you're going for a men shot and you don't stomp your foot, you don't get the point?
If your foot's hanging up in the air when you land that blow, you're not going to get a point. No, if it's just if it's just all arm strike, if you're like you're falling over or you're leaning backwards, your form looks like crap.
Well, so it really is a lot to think about, isn't it? You know, it's not just kind of like you see in the movies where you just got to try to whack the guy any way you can. I mean, in these competitions, you really have to think about not only, you know, where you're going to hit the guy, but your footwork, how are you going to yell? And also, like you mentioned, what area gets you the most point, right? Because if you're going for a doe strike and he goes for the men strike, then he gets the higher point, right?
Right, and then you'll get nothing.
You'll get nothing.
Yeah, they'll only award one point or another.
So wow, I'm surprised to hear how much is involved in these competitions, because when you actually kind of look at it on TV, that doesn't translate that much on television, you know?
Because the movements are very subtle. As I said, there's not a whole lot going on. There's not a lot of dancing going on in a kendo match like there is in a fencing, a traditional fencing with a foil or an épée or something. They're squaring up. You guys are going to move pretty linear right at each other. You're both going to take your best shot. And, you know, maybe one of you got it exactly right and the other one didn't. And that's kind of part of the whole samurai philosophy, though.
Right.
You set your nerve. You rush in. You give it your best shot. You live or you die. And either one is fine. As long as your honor is intact, as long as you set your nerve, rushed in, and did your attack. And that, you know, backing up is not part of the whole samurai ethic. So that's one of those reasons why you'd better have landed a really good strike on your way back. But you'll see the guys are locked up, right? Hilt to hilt, nose to nose practically. They're screaming the whole time, yeah, you know, playing these games. And then all of a sudden they'll push off each other and try that men strike. It's almost like a desperation act of, you know, the two fighters coming out of the clinch that kind of take a swing at each other. Because 9 times out of 10, you're not going to get that backing up point.
So in the competition, how many points does it take to win?
Well, a full thing would be 2, but there's time running as well. So a lot, because it's as you can imagine, it's kind of difficult to get a point, except against me. it's kind of difficult to get points. So a lot of these things end with, as I remember, the term was Ippon Shobu, I think, which meant it's a 1-point victory. It's 1-0. A whole lot of tournaments end 1-0. 2 points is the automatic victory. So if you walk in the ring and they say, Hajime, pop, you get a point. They back you back up basically to your neutral corners, if you will. Hajime, pop, you get the other point, it's over. It doesn't matter that it only took 7 seconds. You got your 2 points, it's done. And the tournaments that I was in were always single elimination. And you just moved on against the next opponent. But more often than not, at least at the levels that I was competing at, what would happen is, you know, these guys would fight, they'd fight. I think it's 2 minutes or 3 minutes. You know, minute and a half in, somebody might get a point. Boom, and they're like, yay, and everybody cheers. And they'll fight, and then time will be up, and nobody else will have scored again, and it'll end up as a 1-0. And I think you're probably going to ask me next what happens if it's 1-1 at the end of time, and I honestly don't remember. I can't remember if they award you a tie, which would be the usual Japanese kind of thing to do, or if they actually would do an extended round to determine the winner.
Well, just looking on Wikipedia, it says that in the case of a tie, there are 3 options. The match is declared a draw. The match continues until either competitor scores a point or the victor is decided by the referee. So that's from the wisdom of Wikipedia. How long is each match?
I want to say that 2 minutes or 3 minutes. No, they're really relatively short. I cannot remember, but I want to say they were somewhere in the 2 to 3 minute range.
So there's no rounds. It's just a 3 minute match, and whoever gets 2 points first in that 3 minutes wins.
Exactly, as I remembered. And the closest thing to kind of a round is if you score a point, if somebody scores a point, as I said, they'll back you up, right. And you'll kind of get yourself set again, and you'll square off again, and the guy will be holding up his hand, and then he'll drop his hand and scream, Hajime, and you'll start again. But there's no like break where you come over to your corner and your coach tells you what you're doing wrong and where his weaknesses are.
Were there any women competing in kendo? Do they participate in kendo?
They do. You'll see them sometimes around the train stations, and they were at the tournaments that I was at, and occasionally when we'd have visits from other dojos, again, all still JMSDF, we would have some women come into our dojo. We did not have any that were actually regular members of our dojo, but it wasn't a. I think there may be whole girl kendo classes that might be doing it at the high school level and all that stuff, but at the tournaments that I was at, it might be 1 in 10, 2 in 10, you know, that kind of ratio.
So then the difficult question then is, how did you do in your competitions?
Really, really badly. I'm not ashamed to say it. I kind of felt like, I got to tell you, I kind of felt like I got my show done by being a novelty. I kind of felt like my senseis were really great guys, and they may have gone in there and said, hey, you know, gee, remember, he's a foreigner. Let's not, you know. And the only thing that keeps me from thinking that is that, you know, they wouldn't want to do anything that would tarnish their sport. But, you know, Shodan, as great as it sounds, it's everybody in the tournament's a Shodan, just about. I mean, at least a Shodan. I don't think you can even compete if you're not at least a Shodan. So it's kind of, in kendo, it's sort of the baseline. You know, I wasn't doing kendo. I did kendo 10 years, and I finally got my black belt. I think I did it 3 months when I took my EQ test. And then about 3 more months, and I took my Shodan test, and I did not feel like I had done anything particularly worthy of getting that belt. But the senseis were all like, no, you're doing great. You're doing great.
Well, that's really great. Thanks, Lance. Thanks for coming on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you and learning about the world of kendo.
Yeah, it was a great sport. It was a lot of fun. It was something that I know they do have dojos occasionally back in the States, and there's kendo clubs and all that, but it wasn't something I was probably going to find where I lived in Fort Worth, Texas before I joined the Navy. So I was glad to come over here to the sport's birthplace and do something a little different than just the usual karate or, you know, jujitsu or that kind of thing.
Cool. Thank you very much.
All right.
I wanted to thank both my guests for coming on the show today. If you're interested in finding out more about kendo, I would highly recommend going on YouTube and doing a search for the kendo 8th dan test. You might also search in Japanese for the Hachidan test. And what this is one of the hardest tests you can take in kendo. There's a lot of restrictions in regards to this test. You have to be a certain age to take it. And the testing itself is rather unique. You have to kind of, as I understand it anyways, you have to kind of prove you're worthy of the 8th dan test. So there's actually a written exam. You have to prove your skill with the kata and the sword, and then you do these fights against these other guys. But it's not so much who wins or loses, but who fights with the most honor, and it's all determined by a panel of judges. So it's a fascinating documentary that's on YouTube in regards to the 8th dan, the Hachidan test in kendo. Flipping over to Canada, we have our own sport with sticks and fighting. It's called hockey. And if you want to get into some good old-fashioned hockey, minus the fighting, do a search for tokyohockeyclub.com. Click on the join button, send them your email, and they'll put you on the mailing list, and you can come out and play some hockey with some good old Canadian boys. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. Don't forget to check me out on Facebook at facebook.com/tokyopodcast. Actually, I also want to mention that I am available on Gaijinpod now. Gaijinpod is the large foreigner website here in Japan, and I've teamed up with them to put the podcast in their living section. So if you go to gaijinpod.com and you check out their Living in Japan section, you will start to see my shows appearing under there, and you can listen to it directly from the Gaijinpod website. So that's always exciting. That's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.